Yes, how you doing today, Troy? And by the way, in case Mr. Warner gets away, thank him for me for being very patient and sticking around here. I think it was worthwhile for him, though. When people say that they can't influence government, they're wrong, folks. It's amazing what can happen, how you can affect government. Keep that in mind the rest of your life. Don't just gripe about it. Be a part of it. And by the way, you know what? You won't always win. You'll never believe it, but Senator Dukes and I lose sometimes, too. You know, you do the best you can. I'd like to thank the Director of Transportation for his courtesy and his patience with the chair today. Appreciate it. Troy, you're up.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Troy Costales, the manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I do have a presentation. You have a copy of the slides, and I'll also be present on the screen to the south side of the room. Walk through some of the issues and items that were requested by your committee when it comes to highway safety in the state of Oregon. I'm going to cover four particular areas quickly. The causes and priorities that we have in highway safety in the state of Oregon. Issues around fatalities that are occurring in this state. What's happening in relationship to injuries and traffic crashes. And what does the future hold given this past session and what's going on nationally and in some cases relating to September 11th attacks. And it does have an impact on highway safety. First, just for a little bit of history, just seven short
Take
years
attention
ago.
Attention to the wall over there.
Seven years ago, in 1995, we had an overall fatality rate of 1.75. What that meant is if you went and drove a million miles in your car in the state of Oregon in 95, you would have seen 1.75 fatalities in your million-mile travel.
And you might have been one of those, too.
And it was unacceptable. And so the Governor's Safety Committee established a long-range goal, a 15-year goal of 1.30, which was basically a 25% reduction. In 1995, 96, 97, our numbers started to improve drastically. And so in 1998, the Governor Committee said, you know, we think we can reach this goal of 1.3 by the year 2000, not 2010. And believe it or not, we reached that goal in 1999. So a new goal has been established that by 2010, we get to an overall fatality rate of 0.99. That means that from a period of 1995 to 2010, we will hopefully have seen a 43% reduction in the number of highway fatalities on the roads and streets in the state of Oregon.
Would you repeat that once again?
If we reach our goal of 0.99 by 2010, in a 15-year period, we would have had a 43% reduction in the number of highway fatalities in the state of Oregon. Mm-hmm. If we hit the long-range goal that's been established by the Governor's Safety Committee. One of the causes of highway crashes and fatalities in particular has to do with drinking and driving. This has been a continual focus of the legislature ever since it became a big issue in the early 1980s. And this particular slide you see here is relating to something that was passed during the 1999 session about impacting and increasing the fines related to repeat offenders who choose to drink and drive more than one time. In 2000, nearly 39% of all of our traffic fatalities were involved in an alcohol-related crash, meaning someone behind the wheel had alcohol in their system. It does continue to be one of the leading factors in traffic fatality crashes. And one thing to note that's an emerging issue in impaired driving is that since 1995, drug-impaired driving, the arrests for drug-impaired driving have gone from 428 to almost 1,200 in 2000. And one thing to note with drug-impaired driving, Oregon's DUI law is very slim. It is very, very specific. And right now, officers are picking up drivers that are under the influence of drugs that cannot be charged with DUI because our definition is so slim. The individuals are being charged with reckless or careless or something like that.
What do we need to do?
One of the potentials is to look at what other states have done, which is starting to talk about any foreign substance in the body that impairs mental and physical ability to operate a vehicle.
That could be antihistamine of some sort even for cold?
First, they would have to have probable cause to stop the individual first, which would then lead to an evaluation of what they may have in their system. We're seeing a lot of people right now that are self-medicating, small amounts of alcohol and over-the-counter medication, and they are thriving as if they were above the .08 legal limit in the state of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
What if we did make a difference? What if we did push and we did and continue to focus on impaired driving? We moved from 39% down to 30% in alcohol-related fatalities. We would see at least 50 lives saved each year by pushing and eliminating the instances of impaired driving in the state of Oregon. One of the other primary areas that we focus on has to do with safety belts, child safety seats, and booster seats. Oregon does have a mandatory law for wearing safety belts for all ages. It is a law that was voted in 10 years ago by the citizens of Oregon. We are the only state in the United States that has a citizen-voted mandatory law on the book. We just celebrated the 10th anniversary last year. And because it's citizen-voted, it is citizen-followed. Oregon is the second highest safety belt use rate in the United States.
I want to just check something. Students here, how many of you use seat belts? Okay, every hand went up. That's very good.
Very good. Our survey in Oregon shows that we have a 91% use rate, second only to California at about 91.7. So we're in competition with neighbors to our north, and hopefully by the end of this...
And the female drivers buckle up more than the male drivers.
That is true, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
You know how that goes.
That's a sexist remark, Senator.
And one thing we have noted, even though we have had a child safety seat law on the books for quite a few years, we're now starting to see another generation of parents with younger children starting again to transport their children in the vehicles in the back seat, not belted or not in safety seats. We're doing another round of education and push and making seats available for free or low cost through health departments in the local county offices and through hospitals and other places all over the state. It is not a geographic-specific issue. It is something that's going on all over.
Some people feel they can't afford, but some people can't afford to buy the car seats.
But one of the things that I like to say is that the first best hug you can give your child is your own. The second is to make sure that they're in a belt or in a safety seat. So if something does happen and it's a minor collision, they're secure and they're not bouncing around inside of the car when it comes to a stop due to a crash.
Okay. Good point to keep in mind, you guys.
What if we continue to improve on safety belt use and went from 91 to 95%? We would, based on the numbers of incidents around the state, save an additional 30 lives each year by just increasing 4 more percentage points of safety belt use.
So we've just saved 80 people if we follow these last two.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Third area that we look at is speed, and this is not in Oregon, and this is not a real picture, just one of those graphics that's glued together, but you have an Apache aircraft enforcing speed limits there on this particular highway. But speed is an issue within the state, and this legislature over the last decade or so has gotten involved in a lot of conversations about speed and speed limits. One thing to note, in 2000 we had 178 crashes on our roads, almost 44% that involved speeding or too fast for conditions.
Right now, these were crashes that, 44% had fatal crashes to them.
Okay. Correct. 44% of the fatal crashes involved someone behind the wheel going too fast.
Class, thank you folks for coming today. And remember to use your seatbelt. We'll see you again.
Bye.
Goodbye. Okay, go ahead, Troy.
Mr. Chairman. And as far as the traveling public goes, somewhere between 43% and 64% of the drivers are exceeding what is on the sign throughout the state of Oregon. And it is unfortunate to note that today, speed and impaired driving are now tied as the leading cause of the fatal crashes throughout the state of Oregon. If we are able to push and make a difference in speed-related crashes and move that number from 44% down to 30%, we would save an additional 80% or 80 lives each year in the state of Oregon. One of the topics that I was asked to address to the committee had to do with teen driving. This is a poster that was also turned into a TV ad and a handout and a map to getting your license that young drivers received due to the graduate driver licensing bill from two sessions ago. This particular campaign, by the way, did receive regional and national recognition as a government public information education outreach program because it was done very well and recognized by the people that are involved. 1998, the year prior to the graduated driver license law, we had 1,200 16-year-olds behind the wheel when someone was killed or injured. They're in the position and point control of driving. The year after the graduated driver license law went into effect, that number was below 900. That's a 25% reduction. In addition to that, the responsibility for driver education was shifted from the Department of Education to the Safety Division of ODOT. And one thing we've noted is that just under 16,000 high school sophomores are taking driver education, and it is voluntary, yet there are 30,000 that are not. With the graduate driver license restrictions and with some changes being made to the curriculum standards for driver education, we are making a difference and continue to make a difference. This drop of 16-year-olds is almost twice as large as what the population as a whole. So there is something significant that has occurred, and that's the driver education program and graduate driver license. The other subject
I'm... Madam Chair, can I ask a question? What are we doing from the state level to help? I mean, my guess is that some of those 30,000 kids that aren't taking it are in areas where it's not offered, and I'm also guessing that they may be rural, because in an urban setting, if you can't get it at school, you can get it at the community college, you can get it from a private company. Those options may not be available to some other kids. What are we doing to try to help make sure everybody has an opportunity?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the program of driver education now tied to the teen license, when the 99 bill went through, it was limited solely to the high schools and to some community colleges. Their programs are the only ones that were available to be tapped as official and move forward. During the 2001 session, we came forward and asked for a bill and expanded it so that now private high schools, private commercial schools, educational service districts, federal schools, there's a lot of other places that have a tied education or the ability to offer the class that now fall under the bigger umbrella of driver education so that their certificates, their curriculum standards match those of the program prior to 2001.
Okay, that helps, but what does that do for me in Napa, Oregon? You know, the school doesn't have one. How do those kids...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, the only other thing that's out there that acts as an incentive is there is a student driver training fund that has passed the muster of the constitutional limitation of highway funds that can reimburse a facility, public facility, up to $150 per student if they so choose to offer the course. So it can subsidize and help the school district or the ESD offer the course. We are going to have pockets of the state not covered as long as driver education stays secondary as an education standard versus it being mandatory. Student driver training fund.
Thank you.
$150 maximum reimbursement per pupil completing the course.
Can you remind school districts of this some way annually so that they're very aware of it?
Mr. Chairman, every year we send out notifications to the superintendents and, of the school districts and the principals asking if they are offering and giving them the rules and things that are involved with the program every year, even though right now 124 different facilities participate. It could be greater, but we remind them with every year at least once. The other area I was asked to cover had to do with the new law from 2001. It had to do with the booster seats, which is the 4 and 5 year olds or the children between 40 and 60 pounds. We have done a tremendous amount of outreach relating to this. We have created a frequently asked questions flyer, because it's just generally just questions. You know, does my child fit or not? What do I have to do? And we've distributed 40,000 pieces of information throughout the state. Law enforcement, child safety seat technicians, hospitals, pediatricians, child care centers. We have done outreach in Spanish and Russian. We have purposely contacted the 7,500 foster care parents around the state, because quite often they get left out of the conversation and sometimes find out too late. We We have 130 law enforcement officers that are trained specifically in child safety rules and laws and how to put them in the car and how to make them be used correctly. They are trainers to train their law enforcement agencies all around the state, all over the state. And we've also arranged for a tremendous amount of booster seats to be available for free or at low cost, 500 through WIC qualified families. Boost America, which is a Ford motor company program, will be here July 11th in Portland to give out an additional 2,500. And the safety division at ODOT have given out thousands as well through clinics, through health departments, and other outreach all over the state to try and just saturate the state with the knowledge as well as the resource, which is the seat, in order to do it right for these 4 or 5 year olds.
You know, I'm a supporter of this new law, voted for it, and yet there's one little problem I see with it, and I got caught in it just recently because I picked up my granddaughter at school, and we have a booster seat, and we keep a booster seat in our car, and they have one in their car because she's under 60 pounds. But her friend was coming home and going to gymnastics with her, which is just down the street a walk. And I'm like, gosh, here's this girl, this other little girl, and I have one booster seat in the car. And there she is. And I'm saying, oh, my gosh, what do I do? How do I work this out? And so I ended up breaking the law at that particular point. And I was just trying to how people are working this out. And I haven't gotten it solved yet, you know, and that's when you're juggling kids around sometimes after school.
Yeah.
It's really I'm not saying we shouldn't do the law, but I'm sensing that frustration some people may get into with it for a certain time. I didn't know how to solve the problem that day.
One of the things that we hope happens as the law is in place for a while is that individuals understand, just like they leave for small children, quite often they'll leave the infant seat or the car seat or the diaper bag, that when they know the child's going to be shuffled around, that they're leaving the booster seat as well that goes with the child, so that wherever it is that's picking them up, if they don't have the seat, they have it available. Going to take some time to work its way through and everybody get used to doing that. There's one other thing that we're working with Representative Devlin, who is the sponsor of this bill. We do have situations where vehicles have lap-only belts. Booster seats are not built and tested to go with lap-only. They are made to go with elongating full back,
right,
lap shoulder. So there is a potential of a concept coming forward for next session that exempts lap-only situations, because we have no data indicating that lap-only versus a booster seat in a lap situation, which is not manufactured, which one's safer or which one is less unsafe. One of the things we're looking at in the state of Oregon law, which Washington and California have in their laws by rule, is an exemption for lap-only situations, which quite often is in the center middle back, which could potentially alleviate some of the multiple child situations where you don't have more than one seat.
Okay, in the middle seat, I'd had a lap only, I guess.
That's a potential.
Yeah. It wouldn't be legal now.
But still not legal to do that.
Not today.
Not today. But it might be better to give the agency authority to do some things by administrative rule than to put into law that you don't, because if the research changes, then...
Yeah.
Senator Dukes, I agree. Current law locked in a very specific with no agency.
Yeah, we do that.
As I said, my comment wasn't made to be critical of the law, and I'm still very supportive of it, but I was just had to deal with it.
Well, it's different than an infant seat, because infants don't get juggled around quite as often as little kids bring home their friends from school.
I never had trouble with that, because we have little infant grandkids too, and but this one, you're juggling kids around, taking them to gymnastics and so forth, and
My daughter's 4 years old, and we have 3 seats, one in each car and one that goes with her.
Oh, yeah. We're loaded with car seats around it.
The other area, Mr. Chairman, that I was asked to address had to do with work zone safety. The slide that you have in your packet and on the wall is a theater slide. We've got 4 or 5 different ways that we're doing outreach. This is it's been give them a break for quite a few years. This one is now starting to talk about slow down, my mommy and daddy work out there, with pictures of real folks that work out there. The next slide gives you an indication of what we're looking at in relationship to fatalities in work zones across the state of Oregon. That is construction and utility and others, anywhere it impacts the roadway. What's interesting to note is look at the last 5 years in Oregon, how that number has absolutely dropped. In the last 3 years, nationally, that number has gone up 33%.
Yeah.
Oregon is going the absolute correct direction and absolutely against the way what's happening all across the United States. More and more of the fatalities these last few years have been the people in the car, not the people in the work zone. And they are now starting to occur not in the exact work zone, but in a transition zone, the lead-in area into the work zone. And so we've been trying to push real hard with state, city, county utilities that the signs they put up are true and accurate. They are making sure that they not only concentrate on the travel patterns in the work zone, they concentrate on the messages and the travel patterns preceding the work zone. And we have a ongoing contract with Oregon State Police that they provide about $500,000 a year worth of patrol in highway work zones, and we're encouraging cities and counties to do the same thing with their police department or their sheriff's offices as well, in order to be visible in our work zones, because that means something's different. You're telling something, a different message to the driver than you normally would expect in that area.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
I appreciate all your work with that. I had a city at one point that decided to cite some people for violating a work zone, when in fact all of the work was done. The only reason the barricades were still up was because we were going to hold an opening ceremony. And the city got some revenue off of that, and I guess that's nice. So the newspaper had announced that the road was open, and I mean, one of the ladies had the darn thing on the newspaper article on the seat next to her. And so I think anything you can do, if people become conditioned to being cited for driving in areas or thinking of work zones as areas where there may not be work going on, then they become more relaxed. And anything we can do to narrow down a work zone to be an actual zone where work is going on or there's equipment hanging around that we have to be careful of or whatever that is, I think... they'll pay more attention to it. And do you have a chart showing actual number of road or utility workers who were killed? I looked at that and thought, oh, gosh, we somehow managed to kill six workers, but these are the people maybe who were driving and ran into the equipment or ran into the concrete or the car in front of them. Or what? Do we know how many workers in the last couple of years, last two or three years?
Sure, both things. First, our public opinion survey echoes exactly what you said. Signs are up. Somebody better be there. And they better be
We see it all the time, and it's very frustrating.
The second is those numbers you see there are a combination of both. Those are the individuals in the work zone that are being struck by motorized travel or the people in the vehicles. And we can split that out if you like. The transition has been away from the individuals in the zone working, and it's because those numbers are now starting to represent more and more of the people in the vehicles themselves.
And that makes sense, but since our public service stuff has been on the workers, that's what we've been trying to educate people to do, is to watch for the workers and to slow down for them. I would be curious to see where we have gone. I haven't heard of a fatality in a worker in a while, but that doesn't mean there haven't been some.
What I'd like to pick up, Mr. Chairman, now is just to show you how the big three of alcohol, speed, and belts interrelate. In 2000, there were 116 people killed in traffic crashes that were not wearing their belts, 146 people killed in speed-related crashes, and 174 that were in alcohol-related crashes. This next graphic just starts to show how do those three things interrelate. First, there's the 116 with no belts, 174 that are in alcohol-related, and 146 with speed. There were 44 only where the only error was no belts. There were not speeding, and there was no alcohol present. There were 77 where the only incident was alcohol. They were wearing their belts. They were not speeding. 67 where speed was the only factor. They had their belts on, and they had no alcohol in their system. 11 with speed and no belts. 29 where there was no belts and alcohol. 36 where there was alcohol and speeding, 32 that had a combination of all three. I would like to call your attention to is a couple items in this slide, and that is that if you watch here, there were 51 fatalities that involved alcohol and belts. That's more than with no belts. the no belt alone. So alcohol is having an influence on the risk-taking behavior of the people involved. And the same thing with alcohol and speed. You have 68 fatalities involving alcohol and speed, 67 speed alone. Alcohol is playing a contributing factor in lowering the individual's acceptance level of risk, therefore increasing the risk-taking that they are doing when behind the wheel. So how do we rate compared to everybody else? 10 years ago, Oregon was one of the worst third in the nation. And I'll show a chart for you here that shows that. But we were one of the worst third in relationship to overall safety records. In this past 2 years, we have significantly improved, and we are now one of the best 10 in the United States. Oh. Point out that back in 1999 alone, we saw 124 fewer fatalities than the year before, the largest ever decline that we've ever had in the state since motorized vehicle travel started, 23% drop. Vehicle occupant deaths were the lowest since 1955, bicyclists the lowest in 20 years, motorcycle deaths the lowest since 1963, pedestrian deaths the lowest since 1944, and the motor carrier-related deaths were the lowest, were down 25%. And as we moved forward into 2000 and 2001, that trend continues. This next chart is just illustrates that. Point out two things. In the far left of the chart, the dark line is Oregon. During the 1950s, Oregon was below and significantly below the national average when it came to safety records. If you look from about 1958 all the way to 1997, we were either at or above. We were worse than the national average. But look at the bottom right-hand corner. You see the dark line start to depart again below the national average. We're pushing again. We're making another difference, and we're saving lives and reducing injuries in this state. In 2001, we had 489 fatalities. If we had stayed the same as we were in 1950, the dark line way up the top, not 489 fatalities, we would have had 2,540 fatalities if we had not done all the improvements over the last 40 years that we've been pushing on and trying to make a difference.
So are we seeing, in those days we used to have the basic rule. We had no speed limits. I mean, we had technically a speed limit, but was that a factor?
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer that because we didn't have the specific fatality data on the crashes and the causes. We didn't start collecting that until the mid-1970s.
But the old concept of you drink, don't drive was pushed.
Correct.
Or the buddy driver, what do you call them?
In the early 80s, our alcohol-related number was above 55% when we start tracking that information. Now below 39.
Okay.
This table is the actual count. These are the Oregonians and visitors to the state that have died on our roads and streets. This table has over 250,000 people on there.
250,000 people have died
in the last 50 years in this state on roads and streets. That's significant. And fortunately, though, we can take a little bit of time to smile and say that we're doing a good job. If you look at the far right and the shadow box I've created there, we've had three consecutive years where we've been below 500 fatalities. The last time that we were this low in three consecutive years was 1960, 61, and 62, 40 years ago. And you know about the travel and the population and everything else that's occurred over the last 40 years and what significant number difference that means. Two things to note. Congress created the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration at the federal level in 1967. The Oregon legislature created the Oregon Highway Safety Office as an arm of the governor's office in 1969. We are one of the very few states in the United States that can say we've had two or three years of success to precede when NHTSA or the Highway Safety Program was created.
Very interesting.
This next table is probably the most significant one in all of the tables that you and charts that you've seen, because this talks about the people that are injured. The top line is telling you for every million miles of travel in this state, how many people were injured. So, in 1996, if you'd done a million miles of travel in the state, you would have seen 129 people injured on the side of the road. In that year, the Governor's Safety Committee said, this is horrible. We need to make a difference. So they posted a goal of 102 for 1999. That's what the diamond is. At the same time said, we're going to step up programs and we're going to start making a difference with all of our partners. And that number not only hit 102, it was down at 82. 20% below the goal. So in a matter of 4 years, the 33% reduction, the number of people injured on our roads and streets across the state. And the bottom line is the actual number, but a name with every one of these. In 1996, we had 39,000 people injured. That's bigger than most of our cities. But by 2000, that number had dropped down to 27,500. Significant 30% reduction. But we still have a tremendous number of cities that don't even have 27,000 people in them. That's how many people are being treated or taken to the hospital due to traffic crashes just a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. What does the future hold? In 2001, we were actually on track with having a very low year. And unfortunately, I've got to attach this to the attacks of September 11th. And this is part of what's unfortunate is that people started to self-medicate, started to be distracted. They started to not pay attention. We have reports not only in this state but from all other states that people are going through stop signs and signals and going fast. I've had 20 years of an absolute clean driving record. I've never done it, but they are wandering somewhere mentally, not paying attention to the job of focusing, of being behind the wheel. Just between September 11th and this last weekend, we have seen 60 more fatalities than what we would have expected.
Ooh.
And that the issue there is impaired driving, tense, people just not paying attention. And safety has been lost at the national level. My hope is that we continue to push, at least here in the state of Oregon, to keep safety on the front radar screen. Even though we can celebrate three very low years and rates well below what we would have expected 10 years early of meeting our goals, we still can make a difference, and we still can save lives and reduce injuries and have a positive impact in the state of Oregon. Legislature, fire, health, police, the media, local coalitions, everybody has started to step up to the plate and make a difference. And these numbers, to reflect to you the status of safety in Oregon, show that all that work has done its job. And with that, Mr. Chairman,
that's really a very, very interesting report. I'm sure we could ask a lot of questions, but I'm looking at the time, and I really do need to move on. It's okay. It doesn't mean we're not interested. It just means the time's caught up. But you've been very clear on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Very, very. I'm on the Governor's DUI Committee.
Yes, thank you. We've been on the committee, and I've been doing great work for years.
Great.
You know, it strikes me, if I could just make a comment.
Sure.
It strikes me how accepting we are. I mean, we look at these numbers and we say this is outrageous, but we just treat car fatalities so different than we do other things that happen. You know, if we had a few, I remember when we had those cases of E. coli in the state, you know, and we had all this uproar over it, and everybody was scared, and, you know, we made this big deal, and there was some, you know, serious results from that. And yet we have thousands of people dying in cars every day, and we all just get in our car and go. We don't, you know, and it's, I know we all try to think about safety and everything, but it's just very interesting how in our society we just accept that a lot of people are going to die.
Yeah. This is a holiday weekend, so we're going to have a lot of deaths, yeah. Well, thank you, Troy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I want to apologize to those of you who are waiting for us. I'm sorry, we have gotten a little bit behind in schedule. Claudia Howells from the Rail Division of ODOT. Thank you for your patience this afternoon. Everett?
Good afternoon, Mr. Duck and members of the committee. I'm Claudia Howells. I manage ODOT's Rail Division. Before I begin, in your packet, let me refer to you to a couple of handouts that you may find useful to refer to as I go through my testimony. One of the most important is the rail map, if you're not familiar with, so you know a little bit about what I'm talking about. The rail division is responsible for four key areas related to the 22 railroads operating in the state of Oregon. The 22 railroads include two Class 1 railroads, the Union Pacific and the Burlington Northern Santa Fe. And by way of background, both of those railroads have been through significant mergers in the last few years, which have dramatically changed the operation of the rail system in this state. We also have 20 short lines that range in size from very small to systems of over 300 miles. And we have
the Pacific not exist now? Or?
No. The Union Pacific acquired Southern Pacific and go under the name of the Union Pacific.
Oh, okay.
The Burlington Northern Santa Fe actually merged those two railroads, but they kept both names.
Mm-hmm.
The rail safety section within our division includes an inspection force that covers track, equipment, operating practices, hazardous materials, and the safety of railroad employees. The rail crossing safety section regulates all public highway railroad crossings, inspects all crossings on a regular basis, manages crossing safety improvement projects, and educates the public on crossing safety. The passenger rail program, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with, is responsible for the planning and development of Oregon's growing passenger rail service, including contracting for train and motor car service and supervising rail improvement projects within the high-speed rail corridor. The rail retention and development program focuses primarily on the state's short line system, but also on the main line system to ensure, to the extent possible, the rail lines are retained and the railroads provide a reasonable level of service to all Oregon citizens. I'm going to do a quick overview of the system itself, which, of course, we do not operate, but we do oversee in a number of ways. Overall, the current state of the rail system for both passenger and freight is a little bit of a mixed story. Ridership on the two state-supported trains, and I'll refer you to this nice little diagram, which, by the way, compares last March with this March, kind of a snapshot. Ridership is continuing to grow at a steady pace. In the months following September 11th, growth in ridership slowed, but is now picked up again, despite continuing problems with trains being on time.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Can I ask, did my travel agent get a hold of you? I called one day to make reservations, and she talked to me about, she said Amtrak on the high-speed rail is terribly behind schedule on a regular basis, and it's getting difficult to book tickets because she can't tell people when the train's going to show up.
Chair Duncan, Senator Dukes, that is unfortunately the case. I think we're running a little bit better this week than if you speak.
Okay.
Yeah. One of the things I'm going to talk about is the overall infrastructure issues with the rail system in the state. It affects our passenger trains in that the infrastructure, particularly between Eugene and Albany, is now has chronic slow orders that are being applied by the Federal Railroad Administration. That dramatically affects our on-time performance. In addition to that, once you slow the whole system down, then our problems with freight interference increase. We, Amtrak, the FRA, and Union Pacific are having frequent conversations. As I said, this week and last week was better. We now have what I would describe as day-to-day conversations, making sure that the track is brought back up to get some reliable speed. But I want to talk about that a little more because there's a longer-term fix that needs to come into play. But yes, unfortunately, you're right. Similarly, rail freight, despite the cooled economy, has remained reasonably constant. In fact, both UP and the BN Santa Fe are handling more traffic in and through Oregon than they were even a year ago, which is somewhat surprising. Rail infrastructure, though, is less than optimal. The short lines, which make up over half of the route miles in Oregon, still have significant problems with track conditions, despite a modest amount of public investment and considerable investment from the private railroads themselves. The Class 1 railroads, UP and BNSF, are struggling with aging rail and ties, with a need for more system capacity in terminals and certain line segments. And Senator Castillo, having served on our advisory committee, is well aware of some of the issues within our high-speed rail corridor. As an example, rail tunnels through the Cascades, which actually affect the performance of the Coast Starlight as well as the freight movements, are inadequate to handle double-stack container trains, and many of the passing sidings, and that's where your capacity is in the system, are shorter than those of the typical freight trains operating in some corridors and within the I-5 corridor. Both condition and capacity problems are affecting the performance of the passenger trains in terms of time and ride quality, which is another issue that train or the trackage south of Albany is what's called jointed rail. This is old rail, and for the passenger trains, you can get a pretty bumpy ride. In short, the rail system overall needs capital investment from either the public or private sector to allow to continue operating safely and efficiently. And that provides a segue to a discussion of federal legislation. You'll be hearing from Jason Tell after I finish. He'll talk about the overall transportation issue. I'll hit a little bit on the rail pieces, and he actually is very much on top of this. There are several bills that are currently moving through Congress that, if they pass, we hope will provide additional funding for both short lines and for the high-speed rail corridor. They're making it through the first stage of the process. They still need to go through floor votes on both the House and Senate side, and then for actually to go through appropriations. They said we're working very hard to make sure that those bills actually help us. Some of the bills have some unique funding mechanisms, tax-exempt bonds, tax credit bonds, and we may need some legislation as we get closer to knowing what these things look like for us to actually make use of those programs. Our current ODOT rail-related initiatives, in addition, of course, to our ongoing passenger service, include a number of things. We are in the process of finishing up the major improvement project in what's called Brooklyn Yard in Portland as part of our high-speed rail program. This will improve our runtime and most significantly improve the consistency of the time because it's one of the bottlenecks where trains can get caught from anywhere from 20 to 30 minutes. That is federal funding we actually received in ICE-T that we're finally being able to spend. However, that's the last of the available funding we have available from the federal government if we do not receive additional funds through the current process. That should be done, hopefully, by the end of this month, and assuming that we can run the trains from Eugene to Salem, we'll improve things further north. Eugene and Albany station improvements, which were priority projects in T21, are both beginning to move forward quickly. And those are both very good projects with train stations being restored and intermodal access being improved dramatically. Funding partners in those projects include ODOT and the respective cities, and also Amtrak has provided capital investment in those projects as well. Oregon City is scheduled to open its new passenger station, and with that will be a stop for the Cascades trains, hopefully this fall. That will be nice because that will give us a suburban link that we have not had for the Cascades passenger trains. On the freight rail side, this body passed Senate Bill 753 last session, which provided $2 million in lottery bond proceeds to fund short line projects. We ended up with a little bit of a glitch, as you know, with the litigation, and only recently could begin to spend the funds that were finally freed up. We'd like to get those funds spent this biennium. It looks like we're going to. The map that I provided you has little circles on it. I'll give you a notion. These are the locations of the various rail projects that we will be recommending to the Transportation Commission in June for approval. None of these completely fill the gap by any means, but they do attempt to tackle the worst of the infrastructure problems on, as you can see, a number of lines and pretty well spread throughout the state. In all cases, we have super participation as well as the participation of the railroad financially. In addition, we have that we're actually working on now, we have federal money to the Astoria line, $2 million from the most recent appropriation bill, as well as the remainder of a $700,000 priority project bill from T21. We have another $1.7 million that also was an earmark within the last appropriation bill for Lakeview. The Mount Hood Railroad was approved for what's called a RIF loan. That's a federal railroad rehabilitation loan program. they to date are the only railroad that has been approved for one of these loans. And we, from Senate Bill 763 funds, we are matching or paying what's called the credit risk premium. The credit risk premium is something that actually a member of the Senate committee from last session described as mortgage insurance. I think that's a really good description. We pay up front, the FRA turns around and sends a check to the railroad. So that should be coming online too, in time for a visit from Thomas the Tank Engine. For those of you who know who Thomas the Tank Engine is.
And he's coming to Oregon?
Senator Duncan, Senator Dukes, yes. Thomas is going to be visiting Oregon the end of June. A full-size Thomas will be actually running on the Mount Hood Railroad. If you have children or grandchildren, it's a very neat opportunity. They're expecting something like 45,000 people to come visit. Federal short line investments, I've already mentioned those. The investment for the Astoria line is part of a bigger project involving excursion service as part of the Lewis and Clark commemoration. We still need somewhere approximating $3 million for both operating and a little bit of additional capital. We are working with the communities along the line, the Portland and Western Railroad, which is the operating railroad, the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial Committee, and the Sunset Transit District to secure that service to begin operating in 2004, and will operate during the peak visitor times in 2004 and 2006. We will also make sure...
Wait, where will hold that run?
I'm sorry.
Portland to Astoria.
Portland to Astoria. That goes back to when we used to do it.
But then it went down to Seaside.
Seaside.
They pulled all those pilings out.
Yeah.
Abandoned the line.
Mm.
Just to explain a little bit, this is not going to be anywhere near high-speed passenger service. It is an excursion-style service, and one of the unique features is that it actually allows visitors to get close to some of the significant historical sites that cannot be reached any other way. So it really will be a unique service. We still need some additional funds, which we are working toward primarily through the federal appropriation project. Process. Another little interesting project we're involved in is the East Marion County Excursion Rail Project. We've been providing some technical support to a group in that area that would like to extend a similar excursion style service from Woodburn to Silverton to give an alternative to how you get to the Oregon Gardens. And that ended up being a good project because with track upgrades that will also benefit the freight customers in that area. There are a number of fairly substantial rail users. That's another line that we still have rail that was laid in 1898, and it hasn't been changed out since. It's 65-pound rail, and it's pretty light rail to be handling large freight cars these days. Washington County Commuter Rail continues to move forward. If you're not familiar with this, this is actually a fairly unique project because typically commuter rail connects suburban with urban areas. This is actually a project that will connect suburban with suburban, and this is of particular interest to the FTA because the suburban to suburban link is a piece that is only now being explored.
Because what, Hillsboro to Tualatin or Wilsonville or where?
The Chair Duncan, the line or the service will run from Wilsonville to the Beaverton Transit Center, which will then provide a very easy transfer to the light rail system. Stopping in Tiger, Tualatin.
Yeah.
There's other commuter rail interest popping up all over the state. I think the success of Washington County's project moving forward is generating a lot of interest elsewhere. Southern Oregon has a strong interest in commuter rail in, between Grants Pass and Ashland. The city of Kaiser is interested in extending the Washington County service further south from Wilsonville to Kaiser and Salem. The Lynn-Benton area is interested in commuter rail connecting Lebanon and Philomath via Albany and Corvallis. There's continued interest in service to McMinnville and also service to St. Helens and Scappoose. For the most part, these are corridors and what I call the pre-planning stages. We've yet, except for Southern Oregon, we've yet to do any feasibility studies on all of them. But clearly, local interest is very high.
I'm hearing my mother talking about going, catching the train from McMinnville, going to Hillsborough for 4th of July, you know, and things like
mm-hmm.
that. Well, actually, we had better rail transportation in those okay. days than we do today. Mm-hmm. You had to get around that. They talk about going to Seaside.
Yeah, we all got used to getting into our cars after that, and so
yeah.
it went away.
Yeah.
And now we want to get people out of their cars, so it's
yeah.
coming back.
It goes
yeah.
back around.
I'd hope to have our 2002 Oregon Rail Plan available for you today. Even when I left the office, we were still trying to find out where the boxes were between one building and another. We know that the printing's done, but we just never got to it, so we'll send them out in the mail to all of you. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony.
This is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Questions? Yes.
So, Claudia, on a lot of these, I imagine they're seen as economic development projects for these various parts of the state. Is that how they're being looked at as well? Because it seems like tourism is tied with it on some of these. And,
Chair Duncan, Senator Castillo, I think there's a number of things generating it. One of them is providing a transportation option, but I think both in the case of excursion trains, which I think a few years ago we wouldn't have even taken terribly seriously,
mm-hmm.
That it's definitely economic development. The trains themselves generate their own interest from tourists,
mm-hmm.
and in addition to providing, you know, a transportation link. Commuter rail is clearly economic development, and then sometimes generating redevelopment, I think, as we've seen with even the intercity passenger corridor and the redevelopment of the train station and areas that may have fallen down. Oh, yes.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
Okay, rolling right along and keeping on time here. I'm sorry, Jason. Appreciate you joining us. I understand you have an abbreviated report for us.
Yeah,
right?
I'll do my best.
Okay. I don't know why we're picking on you to make you do an abbreviated report.
For the record, my name is Jason Tell, and I work on federal issues for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman of the committee, for the opportunity to appear today. I was asked to talk about two issues, the most recent federal transportation appropriations legislation and the upcoming reauthorization of the Transportation Equity Act for the 21st century, which is better known as T21. For the sake of time, I think I will skip right to reauthorization of T21, and then if we have time, I'll backtrack and cover some of the other issues. You do have in your handouts my testimony, a one-page summary of the fiscal 2002 appropriations bill, and then a primer that goes into some more details about T21. Congress reauthorizes or updates major legislation in order to keep federal policies and programs current. T21 is the most current authorizing bill for highways and transit. It was enacted in 1998 and it expires at the end of September 2003. There are other authorization bills that cover aviation, rail, ports, and some other modes of transportation that I won't cover here today, but I wanted to make sure the committee is aware there are other bills that cover those other modes of transportation. Funding for T21 comes primarily from the federal gasoline tax, which is at 18.4 cents. And the Highway Trust Fund has two accounts in it at the federal level. It has a highway account that gets the revenue from 15.44 cents of that gas tax, and there's a mass transit account that gets 2.86 cents of the gas tax revenue. And what T21 does is essentially spell out how those federal highway and transit funds are distributed and how they can be spent. I should note T21 is not a block grant program. The state is not just handed a check for federal funds. In fact, the funds are sub-allocated into specific programs, and then they have specific policy goals attached to them. So, for instance, some of the funds we get have to be spent on preserving the interstate system. Some funds have to be spent on bridges, air quality, and some other national goals. And you have some of those programs spelled out in more detail in that primer that I handed out with the other material. The timeline for authorization is pretty much like this. This year, the focus will be on gathering information. Authorizing committees in the House and Senate are currently holding hearings. They're expected to hold field hearings in some locations around the country in addition to in D.C. The U.S. Department of Transportation may also start soliciting input. As they develop their version of the legislation, will be considered next year. National transportation associations and industry groups are beginning to look at legislative changes and what kinds of programs they want to support in the next bill. Next year, in 2003, the focus will be on drafting and debating the different versions of the bill. Congress and the administration will have the goal of negotiating a final bill before T21 expires at the end of September. Historically, though, the last two bills, anyways, they have not gotten done on time. So the one thing I would just note for the committee that the goal is to have a new bill by the end of September of next year, but it could very well go another year or so after that. Sitting here in 2002 and trying to look ahead to reauthorization next year, there's a couple things that have happened, major events that are happening now that I think will help sort of set the tone for reauthorization next year. The first is the economy. The federal surpluses that we've had for only a few years have quickly come to an end. The president's budget that was submitted earlier this year to Congress is a deficit budget, and that situation is going to make it much more difficult, I think, for Congress to consider large funding increases next year. The second is the war. Congress swiftly approved $40 billion in spending for recovery and war efforts following the September terrorist attacks. Congress is now considering additional funding, and defense will likely continue to be the top priority for Congress for the next several years, I expect. The third major event that will happen this year that I think will affect reauthorization are the elections in November. Control of both the House and the Senate are up for grabs. Right now, Republicans have a slim majority in the House, and the Democrats have a one-vote majority in the Senate. And that obviously, the control of those bodies affect who's the chair of the committees, who sets the schedule and the agenda. So that'll be an important factor going into reauthorization. The issues that will be discussed when Congress looks at reauthorizing T21 can be divided into three broad categories: funding, programs, and policies. Funding can be broken down into three types of funding that we receive. The first is formula funds, and that's where the majority of the funds, how the majority of the funds are distributed. And each bill relooks at that complex funding formula that decides how much money each state gets. So that can dramatically impact how much money each state will receive over the next six-year bill period. The second type of funding is sometimes referred to as discretionary funds. Those don't go automatically to states each year. Congress authorizes a program, and U.S. Department of Transportation sets up criteria, timelines, a grant application process, and then people, states, local governments, whoever is eligible, can then submit grant applications, and then USDOT decides who gets the funding. An example of that is the Scenic Byways Program. $20 million is awarded annually for local sponsors and states to submit projects, and then USDOT ranks them, decides who gets the funding, and then they're announced. The third type of funding is earmarked funds. And in each bill, Congress does earmark some of the funding to specific projects. They provide both opportunities and some challenges for us at the state level. One challenge is managing the STIP, the Statewide Transportation Improvement Program, which is basically where we show at the state level where our federal funds will be spent. And one of the challenges that we have is oftentimes earmarked projects are only partially funded. Mm-hmm. So $10 million project perhaps could be earmarked at $2 or $3 million. We have to find the remaining funds to make the project whole and be able to go to contract. So that can force us to have to relook at priorities we've set in the STIP. On the other hand, there's also an opportunity. Congress does set aside money to earmark, and therefore the money will go to Oregon or will go to another state. So I thought I would just mention that briefly, that there's both good and bad that come with those earmarked funds. Another area of issues that will come up in reauthorization is the program structures. As I mentioned, the program isn't a block grant. There are a number of different programs, dozens and dozens of programs, that decide how the funds can be spent. And in reauthorization, there's an opportunity for Congress to review different programs, decide if the eligibility that exists is the right way that the funds should be used, the rules for the programs, the different funding levels for programs. So they'll also take a look at those programs, perhaps even consider developing new programs that can be authorized for the next 6 years. And the third broad category are policies, and these run the gamut from regulatory issues to safety issues to technology issues, just to name a few. It really covers the whole gamut. So in conclusion, transportation has to compete against these other national priorities for funding. There's a tremendous amount at stake in reauthorization for our state. There are these funds, the programs that we have to live with, and the policy decisions that are made. Earmarked funding can be both an opportunity and a challenge for us at the state level. And in light of recent national events, I think the budget situation we're going into is going to make it a tough year next year. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Isn't the majority of the IST money federal gas tax money?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, that's correct. The 18.4 cents federal gas tax, about 80% of that revenue goes to the highway account of the Highway Trust Fund, and about 20% goes to a mass transit account. Unlike the state Highway Trust Fund, the federal trust fund has two accounts. It funds highway and transit programs, but that's correct. That's the primary source of funding.
And are those budgets still off budget? Still being used?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, you hit on a major issue and a major accomplishment in T21, which was prior to T21, the revenue going to the Highway Trust Fund was considered part of the unified federal budget, meaning spending from the trust fund is scored as part of the overall budget. So what used to happen prior to T21, by not spending some of the revenue in the trust fund, Congress was able to increase funding in other accounts. So, for instance, if education was a major issue in a given year, Congress could choose to not spend some money in the trust fund, let it sit there, and it would allow them to boost spending elsewhere in the federal program and keep the budget in balance. That created a major issue for transportation supporters who looked around, saw a tremendous need, and saw a balance accumulating in the trust fund. T21 fixed that by a provision known as RABA, which is another acronym, Revenue Aligned Budget Authority. And essentially what that does is it says all revenue that comes to the trust fund can only be spent on transportation. So it will be viewed differently than the rest of the budget. And that has allowed an increase in funding over the life of T21. And going into reauthorization, maintaining that provision, maintaining that firewall between the general budget and the trust fund is not a given. Transportation supporters will have to fight, I think, very hard to keep that firewall there with declining revenues in a lot of areas in the budget. Folks who are supporters in other areas look to the trust fund and the revenue generated by the gas tax and have a lot of different ideas of how they'd like to use that money, so I think we have our work cut out for us.
But as you were talking about September 11th and the war and all of those other things being a factor in how much money we could get, the money is still there. So that it's...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, that's
technically
correct.
Technically speaking, we ought to be able to get as much money as we got last time.
We will get the whatever amount of revenue is generated by the federal gas tax, we will get for transportation if we keep these RABA provision in place in the next bill. What I meant by making the budget situation difficult is, number one, if defense, for instance, is a major recipient of funding, education perhaps may not get as much, or agriculture or another area. That then puts pressure on those groups maybe to look at the trust fund and maybe take another run at opening up those funds. The other thing it does is, as the committee I think is aware, we have more and more alternate fuel vehicles coming online, hybrid, and some other things that essentially are eroding the amount of revenue we're getting from the trust fund. So at some point, we are going to have to look at not just living with the current rate, the federal gas tax rate, and just be able to have continued growth in the program. We're going to have to look at other alternate ways of financing transportation in addition to the gas tax, or perhaps instead at some point in time. There are some groups calling for an increase in the federal gas tax or perhaps indexing the federal gas tax and some other things. And those things, I think, will be discussed, but when overall you have a budget that's tightening, it makes it a little bit more difficult. So.
Okay. I have one other question, Mr. Chair. You prepare a briefing book on the highway projects for Congress. Do you include in that briefing book the airport, transit, and rail projects as well?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, we have two things we do each year. We have a briefing book, which is more of a reference tool. It has maps of the different systems we have. It explains specific programs. I think what you're referring to is the delegation each year asks the department if they have an opportunity to earmark funds in some of these programs that Congress does earmark. What projects do we have ready to receive the funds if they can get it? In the past, we used to cover highway, transit, whatever rail programs, which are a small part of T21, and aviation. Now that we no longer have aviation within ODOT, we don't address the aviation issues. We continue to comment on the highway and the transit programs.
We do.
Yes, Jenny.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we, that, excuse me, the rail is not transit and light rail, but heavy rail and passenger rail improvements would be in T21.
Chairman Duncan, Administrator Atkins, it's T21 itself has a very small, two small programs that deal with rail, and one of them deals with high-speed rail, and the other deals with short-line rail funding. Currently, as Claudia Howes mentioned, Congress is considering separate legislation that would create capital funding programs, real capital funding programs that would invest major amounts of federal funds or create bonding that states could take advantage of to advance capital. In reauthorization, it's possible the committees could look at putting more rail into T21. They could keep the issues separate. But right now, it's a small portion of the overall bill. The bill's primarily highways and transit.
Okay. Well, thank you. By the way, what is the federal gas tax? I can't recall.
Mr. Chairman, it's 18.4 cents a gallon.
18.4, okay.
Gasoline.
Okay. Thank you very much, and you're pretty much. We're getting there, Jim. Come on up. Okay. I don't know if you can condense any of it. We've been trying to pick up a little time with Jim, so I'd like to adjourn close to 4 o'clock if we can make it. Because sometimes we ask a lot of questions, but. Where is it?
Recognizing the fuel tax as a decline, I guess I should start with my name, shouldn't I?
Yes.
I've never done this before. My name is Jim Quitty. I am the Transportation Funding Task Force's Administrator for the Oregon Department of Transportation.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Recognizing the fuel tax as a declining revenue source for Oregon's road system, the 2001 Legislative Assembly sought to address the long-term viability of Oregon road finance by passage of House Bill 3946, mandating formation of the Road User Fee Task Force. The legislature adopted the following statutory purpose for the task force: to develop a design for revenue collection for Oregon's roads and highways that will replace the current system for revenue collection. The members of the task force were appointed last November by the governor, speaker, and Senate president, and the first meeting was held last November 30th. The list of the task force members is attached to my testimony that's before you. First, a task of the Road User Fee Task Force was to understand the nature of the risk to the road finance system. The task force has learned the following.
It's not
coming up?
No.
Oh, well. We'll have to go with paper slide.
Well, we haven't met here lately, so it's okay. We've been doing that most of the day anyhow.
Okay. The state of Oregon is, the first thing we learned is the state of Oregon is heavily dependent upon fuel taxes. For 2002, state and federal fuel taxes are roughly two-thirds of total state revenues for roads. This would be the second, look at the second slide, which is our makeup there. Of the road finance elements for Oregon. And then the third slide breaks it out into the two major elements, which are gas tax, federal and state. As of this year, we rely on 70% of our revenue, of our road finance revenues in Oregon, on the gas tax.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that varies with time. Sometimes it's lower. Right now, we're that high. Our ability... To pay for roads is heavily at risk if the fuel tax revenues flatten or decline.
Well, we just heard the federal fuel tax is 18.4
and the state's 24 cents.
24 cents. Okay.
Okay, the second thing we learned is that the fuel efficiency of Oregon's automobile fleet has eroded fuel tax revenues over the past 30 years.
Go to slide 4. You can see the this is the fuel efficiency chart over the last 30 years, going from 11.4 to 19.6. That has a dramatic effect on our revenues. Go to the next slide, slide 5. It has a blue line going from 1960 to 2002. As you can see, the gas tax revenues have been increasing during that time with some dips for a recessionary period. Go to the following slide with a pink line added to it. You see that the pink line represents the gasoline that would have been consumed but for fuel efficiency, which is, as you can see, more than double. This is where we would be. What is the effect on? I want to show you, go to the next slide, going with the red circle on it. I want to look at focus on those last few years for a moment and to the following slide. From 94 to 2002, as you can see, we had been increasing up until around 98, 99, and now we're starting into a flat period right now. Now, I think the economy has something to do with this, but I also think that fuel efficiency is gaining as well. We're watching this closely because over time, this is our challenge. Go to the next slide. We have the revenue picture, the green line. As you can see, it's going up. We see in the late 80s and very early 90s, we had a big increase. Those were the gas tax bills that were passed during that time. Following line, this is what the revenue would have been without fuel efficiency. Following, the difference is $10 billion over that period of time. It was lost owing to fuel efficiency. Now, we're not complaining about fuel efficiency. It's a good thing environmentally.
It's the revenue problem we've got to figure out.
And it's a good thing from a resource conservation perspective. It's just that we didn't plan for this revenue drop-off.
If you go to the following line, you add the inflation difference, which is the pink line, and that's $5.7 billion. Go to the final one.
Now, the further improvement of fuel efficiency, particularly with the introduction of hybrid electric vehicles, will likely have an even more dramatic effect on fuel tax revenues in the not-too-distant future.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at that slide with the two cars on it,
mm-hmm.
The standard vehicle is roughly 20 miles per gallon. This is your standard vehicle. It pays, based on 12,000 miles a year, $144. If you compare that to the hybrid, you can see the problem right there in front of you. The final slide indicates what's projected.
Ms. Atkins has brought up an interesting point.
Yes.
All of a sudden, the standard vehicle is now one of these, not an SUV, SUV.
Yeah. Well, I'd be delighted to accept criticism on that point because I chose that vehicle as the standard vehicle. I have no idea what.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The other day, I was talking earlier about taking my granddaughter to gymnastics, and I parked out there, and
I bet there are a dozen vehicles lined up. Mine was one of them, and I think there was one other. Every other vehicle, and they talk about soccer moms, I guess, because most of these were mothers bringing their kids to gymnastics, mm-hmm. but they were all driving from this vehicle.
Mm.
It was a standard vehicle that day.
Okay, well, I guess that my anecdote.
I felt completely out of place. Okay.
The final slide indicates what we expect to see. Now, these numbers are guesses, but we do know that this method of using the electricity generated by the vehicle and then looping it back through the vehicle and capturing it for later use is a very fine mechanism and is likely to be adopted by other vehicles. Right now we have Honda Civic as an option for that. And then in the fall, we know that Ford's coming out with a Ford Escape SUV that will have a hybrid electric option.
Toyota has one too, don't they?
They have a full-blown one right now, but we're talking about standard vehicles, not one that was designed for this purpose. This is becoming more and more common with the regular car. We're at the beginning. We're trying to get a handle on it before it gets us.
Are you saying that you're going to capture... you're going to use electricity, and you're going to capture revenue?
Well, that's where our challenge is. The gas
yeah.
revenues are projected to drop off
right.
at some point. They're going to flatten first, and then they're going to actually take a dip.
Will this all reduce speed, by the way, these hybrids?
I don't necessarily think that's the case.
That's not a fact.
Because when they're running on gasoline and you want speed, you can use the gasoline element. It's just that when you're driving at lower speeds, you can use the electric element. Plus, when you're doing things like braking downhill, there's a loss of energy on the current vehicles, and that will be captured by the hybrid. So it generates its own electricity.
Okay. So the idea of using the fuel tax to take care of the highways will maybe become obsolete.
Yes. Now, the fuel tax is a marvelous tax. Low administration. It takes into account, fuel-efficient vehicles are advantaged under the gas tax. It's a great method of taxation. It's just that it isn't going to last. It's not going to work for us for a long time. We're to the point where it's going to drop off, and what do we do about that?
So, that answer on the last page? I see your answer on the last page.
Yeah, the answer's on the last page.
There it is, right there.
The task force first defined the parameters of its work. It said any future revenue collection system should be a user-pay system. There's quite a discussion about the definition of user, but the task force generally agreed that a user is one who uses the road system rather than any specific road. The task force decided that the new revenue system should be designed without additional revenue in mind, simply design a new system that will ultimately replace the revenue we have available today. Many task force members are strong advocates for additional road funding, but for purposes of this task force, the new design is the primary concern. And the task force decided the new revenue mechanism should be designed to support the highway and road system for the state, cities, and counties, all parts of the state. Finally, the task force wants the new system to be acceptable to the public. Okay. I want to go on and the bill requires us to consider all potential revenue sources. That's what it says. So I took that seriously, and we're looking at everything, any idea somebody comes up with, we're putting in front of the task force. I will go through the list here. Individual facilities.
Oh, we have
you want to see those? Okay.
Yeah.
You can look at those.
Yeah. You won't do a battery tax again, will you?
Battery.
And they're done.
It has been put on the shelf.
Thank you.
Meaning it hasn't been rejected, but it isn't the first preference for work.
Good deal.
Okay. In fact, most of these have been put on the shelf for the time being. The two broad-based funding mechanisms under extensive examination are the vehicle miles travel fee and system tolling. Other more narrow revenue mechanisms also
vehicle
miles traveled is based on your miles traveled in the state. It's not an odometer tax.
What was the weight miles tax? Would that? I'm sorry.
It's headed in that direction in a way.
I'd rather not get into that this afternoon.
This is the tax the rural folks more than the urban folks. I'm joking. There's a way of working it out so it doesn't do that.
Other more narrow revenue mechanisms getting attention are studied higher use permit fee, congestion pricing, and individual facility tolling. These are the five that we're looking at hard. And I don't really want to go into great detail except to answer your questions, because we'll get a chance to do that, say, next fall when our work is...
You laid it out pretty well, don't you? We should pay attention to it.
Mr. Chair?
Any questions for Jim?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm sorry, what was the last one, Jim, that you listed?
Individual facility tolling. There was an interest if we were going to do something new to the part of the road or bridge, that we might want to pay for it with tolling. Not that we would... on existing roads with tolling, but something new.
Oh.
Although funding the whole system by tolling is another possibility, which is what I call tolling.
You remember this is a state that doesn't want a sales tax and doesn't want to pump its own gas?
By the way, I don't know if you folks are aware that Colonel Brown,
yeah,
his obituary was the favorite of the day.
Yes.
Yeah, he's been the leader of the anti...
million people.
Oh,
million.
Oh,
well, Mr. Chair, we'll be back to you in the fall, I believe, because we have to report to the legislature on our early recommendations. Thank
okay,
you.
Well, thank you.
Excuse me for the cough.
That's all right. I can identify with that. Any other questions?
Well, I just have one, and I'm sorry, I was out in the hallway for part of your presentation. But when you were talking about recycling the electricity in the vehicle, are we looking at the possibility of some type of a utility tax there? Or was that a funding, potential funding mechanism?
You mean like run it through the electric utility?
No, I mean somehow keeping track of how much electricity they're generating and using as a method.
Or utility. Yeah.
No, not the traditional utility tax. Been there too, for that one too.
I'm gonna have to write that down and put it in front of them, because it's something we hadn't considered. I don't think the technology is there for for measuring that at this point. It would be a way, though, to then what's not being paid for with a fuel tax is now being paid for in a different.
I mean, if we can do transponders, we ought to be able to do all kinds of things.
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much, Jim. I appreciate you being with us today. Committee members, this has been a very, very interesting day. I'd like to commend our staff for putting together a fantastic agenda. It's been very, very informative. Senator Castillo, we're ordering tapes of the presentation by the students, and I would like to have you see that. Just for,
okay,
for
the, yeah, I'm sorry, I missed that.
They did a great job, and so if we could get that
to
you, if you could take a look at it. It's very short.
Okay.
So I do want to order, I'll talk to you about orders, copies of that, and I'll send it to the school, too. Is there anything else to come before this group today?
You know, I was just thinking, Mr. Chair, relating to the students, if this all works itself out and they get resolution of some type to their problem, I think we should encourage the school district to do a statewide thing on that. Because over the years when I've talked to school districts, the kids just believe it doesn't make any difference. One of my sons, when he was younger, came home with what he considered to be a school-based problem, and it was transportation, and we changed the law. And about 8 years ago, we had, you may remember, the kids from the Tillamook class, and we now have a state beverage. And it was a high school student that got Senator Roberts to create the graphic license plate. Kids have made an impact on state laws in the state of Oregon, and I think that we need to point that out more often, because kids really don't think they can make a difference.
I think it is. I think it's important also, and I think you noticed I said that to them today. You have to remember that you don't always get what you want, and that doesn't mean it's a rejection, because that happens to us as senators. We have ideas, and you don't get 16 votes and so forth. You don't get, and that's the process too. So I wanted to emphasize to them, and I wanted to make it clear to them today too. I gave them a forum, but they're kind of on their own. now, you know, they present their form, their case, and now it has to make her, you either make or break it on the merits of the situation. We give them the form, and that's, mm-hmm. I think that's an important learning tab for them, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to thank the members of the committee, okay. And thank you for coming back, because I know sure. You had to really juggle around to get here. So based on that, I'm going to